the waves blending with the pleasant drifting sensation in his head. To his left, he could hear the distant camp of the former galley slaves. They were singing. The words were lost, but Oates reckoned their voices sounded cheerful enough. At least some had found Salduba to be a place of happiness. He might have slept. It was still dark when he sat up. And he was still fucking drunk. Nice enough for now, but Oates could feel his skull preparing to craft a few iron spikes of agony by sunrise. The mongrels in the camp were silent, most of their fires out. Dawn was a fair span away yet, Oates reckoned. A much smaller light approached him first, coming down from the docks. A lantern, borne by a lone figure. He didn't want company, considered moving on, but the wine mocked the notion of him going anywhere in a straight line and in a hurry. So he stayed planted, a besotted beach turnip. The light made directly for him, its nimbus shielding the intrusive bearer. The figure stopped a few strides away and lowered the lantern to the sand. Thistle stepped around into the pool of light. She looked down at him for a moment, hair tugged by the incessant breeze. Oates turned back to the water and waited for the chastisements to fall.
"I'm so sorry, Oates."
The tender compassion in Thistle's voice washed warmly over him. Guilt delivered a hammer blow in the same instant. Why was she always so kind? He'd never done anything but saddle this woman with burdens. Thistle lowered herself down next to him. They sat together in silence for a long while. Oates nearly asked who was looking after Murrow, but knew it was an unworthy question. Thistle would have made certain someone would be near if the boy woke.
"How'd you find me?" he asked instead.
"A drunken big bastard leaves quite the trail," Thistle replied with a hint of tease.
Oates grunted a laugh, shook his head.
"Fool-ass way to carry on."
"Certainly is, if it's every night, every day. Not with what you've suffered these last months."
Thistle bumped him with her body, forced his attention. She tilted her chin at the discarded bottle near his feet.
"Anything left in that?"
Oates wasn't sure. He managed to snag the bottle after a few failed attempts, but the weight proved a disappointment.
"Just dregs and a little sand," he said.
Thistle clicked her tongue with regret as Oates flicked the bottle back to the beach.
"It's beautiful here," Thistle said after a span.
"Makes a mongrel hate the suns a little," Oates replied. "The lots are supposed to be made of misery. I reckon the claymaster must always have been mad. Can't see how he didn't end up with this during the allotment draw elsewise."
"Perhaps he feared what a refuge like this would do to him, or how it would make him appear. He never did want to show weakness."
Oates often forgot that Thistle's tenure with the Grey Bastards was almost as long as his own. She'd stayed most nights in the kiln, hearing the gripes and confessions of a sworn brother for years. Likely those included the old chief more often than not.
"You ever miss him?" Oates asked.
Thistle cocked an eye at him.
"The Claymaster?"
She let the jest hang for a moment before grinning, showing she knew his true meaning. Her face became somber, the starlight illuminating a fondness in her eyes.
"Rounth was loving. Lusty as polecat, which was fucking exhausting. It was rare that after a day of tending babes I wanted to break the bed, but Rounth had this
keg of a cock."
The wine made Oates say it, and fueled the laughter that followed. He knew it wasn't respectful, but he was watching a mummer's show of himself, a powerless spectator to his own braying japes. Thistle clicked her tongue again, but there was no regret in the sound now.
"He was named for it, but it didn't drive him. Unlike Cat, who would fuck anything, Rounth wasn't ruled by his lust. He wanted me. That's how he made me feel. desired, even when I didn't want to be. He could be dim-witted and selfish. I think you all get that when you don the brigand. And yes, it was often a relief when he was on patrol and I was spared going up to the kiln. And there were many, many nights I considered not going up, even when he was there. But that mongrel could look at me, and I saw this awe, as if he couldn't quite grasp how fortunate he was that I chose to share myself with him. That's what kept me going back. That and the shame that I didn't feel the same.
The confession took a moment to puncture Oates's dulled brain. He didn't have a response. Thankfully, Thistle didn't appear to need one.
I was wed, she continued, talking at the sea. Before all this. A mother. When that life died, I didn't. I made a new one in Winsome. I was a wet nurse, and later, a bed warmer. You hoof riders are honest in your titles. I reckon I knew what was required. Your mother warned me against it, but after a while I needed something other than the orphans. I was already letting mongrel babes suckle from my body. Why not let a mongrel man use it for another purpose? Beryl told me if I was to do it, I should choose Hobnail. She said Rounth was too moon-eyed when he looked at me. I know now she was trying to spare me what she suffered. Loving a rider, only to lose him. Well, I lost him, but I never loved him. Truth is, I can't say for certain I miss him either. Those days seem so far gone, I can't imagine him here. It's as if he's tethered to that time. I don't know how to yearn for something that never was. Too busy hoping for what might be.
And what's that?
Thistle tossed her head back and loosed a nearly silent, mirthless laugh at the sky. They say the gods don't have a place in Ulwundulas, but at least one found its way here to laugh at me.
Oates had upset her. He just wasn't sure when. I'm sorry, Thistle. I'm drunk and...
Upset, I know. Jackal said you wanted to be alone. I should have listened.
Thistle stood, brushed the sand from the back of her skirts.
Truly, Oates, it pains me about Beryl. Know that I will look after her.
You don't have to do that.
I'm not looking for a reprieve from you, or gratitude. Beryl has always been kind to me. She is my friend. We spent years together with Sweeps and Sissy. She and I are all that is left now. I would care for her even if I hated you.
Do you? Hate me?
Fuck all wine to the ending of the world. Why couldn't he keep this foolery locked behind his teeth? I hate that you won't look at me.
That ain't true, Oates said, aware that he turned his gaze back to the surf when he spoke.
You look at me like you fear you'll never be able to repay a debt. Not
all worshipful like Rounth.
Not like a woman you would raise a child beside.
I'm a bastard, Thistle. A half-orc sworn to a hoof. I ain't ever going to raise a child beside anyone.
Then why save him? Murrow, why care?
Because I love him. I won't say it was from the moment I first picked him up. Got him out of that brothel room reeking with his mother's corpse. But before I put him down, I loved him. When he got hurt, when it looked like he was going to die, I knew it would kill me too. If not the pain of it, then the anger of it. The injustice, the rage. It'd make me...
What?
Into something too hateful to let live.
Murrow had survived. And still Oates had committed unspeakable acts.
Lucan had died hard, died ugly. The pitiless nomad struck Murrow once. Oates made him pay with anguishes that stretched half the night, rendered him powerless as a child, and sobbing like one long before the end.
Oates knew the Castile stable master had beaten Murrow too. It was a mercy for the man, and for Oates, that he'd died during the fortress's fall. Thistle's voice reached through the sinking morass of black, bloody thoughts. Oates, look at me.
He shook his head, knowing it would hurt her, but worried she'd see. See straight down into the dark of Sancho's cellar. By the time he reburied the truth and found the courage to face her, she was gone. There was nothing beautiful about the beach in the morning. The stench of low tide set Oates's guts churning. The sun besieged his eyes. He wanted to murder every gull that wouldn't cease trilling, which was all of them. Worst of all was the toe of the chief's boot burrowing into his hip. Oates growled in complaint, but managed to sit up.
"Find your legs," Fetch said, tossing a wedge of bread into his lap. "There's a heap to do before we depart."
Oates took up the bread, rolled it around in his hands while he repeated the words in his pounding head until they made sense. It didn't happen.
"We?" he echoed.
"You're going to Hisparta with me?"
"No one is going to Hisparta," Fetch replied. "It's time to attack Kalbarka."
Chapter 19. Rant and Roar proved their worth in a week, offering the chief priceless guidance on the preparation of her fleet. They hadn't the time to build any ships, but those they possessed were repaired, reinforced, crewed, and loaded under the direction of the mongrel shipwrights. The fleet included both the captured Hispartan war galleys, two merchant vessels outfitted to carry hogs and supplies, and three Tradrian corsairs. The mercenaries would sail as escort as far as the Guadalquivir, then return to the cradle. It was vital the harbor remain protected. To that same end, Fetch ordered Father and the Sons of Perdition to stay behind. Still, the force setting sail from Salduba numbered nearly 400. The former galley slaves comprised the bulk. Oates feared many would rebel at the prospect of taking up the oars once more, especially since they would now be rowing toward battle. But Fetch spent time among them as the ships were made ready, placing Jackal in their camp when she was needed elsewhere. The pair of them might as well have been gods. The liberated mongrels marveled at their presence, laughing at Jackal's jests and setting their jaws in iron when Fetch was near. Oates could conjure memories of Jackal shitting himself on their first patrol ride as slops, his nerves were so frayed. And Fetching used to be so afraid of scorpions, she wouldn't step on one even with a booted foot. But these freshly unshackled half-orcs knew none of that. To them, Fetch and Jackal had begun as stories, rebels in faraway Ulwandulas spitting at the crown, slaying its cavaleros, and taking its castles. They couldn't be killed, it was said. Even the Fix feared them. They had sworn vengeance on Hisparta, offered a haven to all half-breeds. They were powerful, unconquerable, free. By the time Fetching put weapons in their hands, every one of those mongrels was ready to die for her cause. They renamed the ships that once held them in bondage Crownbreaker and Queenslayer, and set to the oars with a fervor that bordered on frenzy. Fetching traveled on Crownbreaker and put Jackal on Queenslayer. The new mongrels were eager to prove themselves, but they were untested and would need their beloved champions nearby should the fleet encounter any Hispartan ships on the way to Kalbarka.
"Didn't we just do this?" Sluggard japed, moments after they were underway. He stood next to Oates on the deck of Fatback. The Stylark sailed to their starboard. Slug and Jackal had made a contest of naming the hog transports. The chief called them both fool asses.
"Ain't exactly joyed to sail through the gut again," Oates replied. "Once was enough."
"Scream on the poop deck, die crashing against the rocks," Sluggard proclaimed with mock bravado. "Doesn't stir the blood in quite the same way." Oates couldn't force the laugh Sluggard sought. He kept his gaze fixed on the dwindling harbor. Thistle had not brought Murrow down to see them off. Oates saw little of them the last few days. He was tasked to help Roar affix stronger rams to the spurs of the galleys. The labor provided unexpected evidence that Oates's old strength was returning.
he felt capable again, a sensation nearly forgotten. From sunrise to sunset, he'd hoisted, hammered, sweated, and cursed alongside one of the surliest mongrels ever to draw breath. The work had proved a far more effective balm than the wine. His nights were equally long and arduous, staying awake into the late watches, planning the attack, hold up with Jackal, and fetching. The hoofs would be hard-pressed to take Kalbarka by storm. That fact remained as true now as it had from the beginning of the war. Cavalry made poor besiegers, whether on hog or horse, and the lots had nothing to breach the walls that could stand outside the range of the city's guns. Fetching had hoped starving the garrison would force them to abandon Kalbarka, but the Frails had not lived up to their name. The city had to be taken by guile, cracked from within. Oates didn't know what connection Bellico had to the place, but all who dwelled in the lots knew the halflings claimed the ancient tunnels beneath Kalbarka as their own, grubbing away in the dark for something their once-human god possessed in life. Whatever it was, the stunted worshippers of the master-slave were Fetch's only hope of capturing the city. She'd urged Zirko all winter to commit his followers to the task, but the hero father had remained adamant in his refusal. He would not command his devout to open the gates. To do so, he claimed, would be a naked hostility toward the kingdom of Hisparatha. Oates reckoned sending Barsius and his killers over the border to aid Thresh and Sluggard's rescue was a worthy risk. Zirko couldn't have his perceived lead to Jhrika getting hanged, for one. Second, the halflings left no survivors beneath Elarina. In a city the size of Kalbarka, however, someone would survive. The tale would reach Hisparatha, if only as rumor. Zirko would have difficulty denying it was his followers who opened wide the gates, allowing the mongrel rebels to enter. Despite all Fetch held over the hero father's head, Zirko stuck to his position. Until now. "Why'd he change his mind?" Jackal asked, sprawled in a chair around the table in Fetch's solar. "Because his people are dying," Fetch replied, rubbing bloodshot eyes. She plucked a missive from the table. Jackal sat up to receive it. He read quickly and passed the note to Oates. "A sorcerer has come to the city. He has ordered the tunnels be cleared. My disciples are hunted. There have been executions. Come swiftly. This must stop." "The crown has drawn first blood," Jackal said. "Not in truth," Oates grunted, thinking of all the slit throats in Elarina's sewers. "Strava couldn't pretend to stay out of this forever," Fetching declared. She slumped into her own chair. "Zirko's folk would still be alive if he'd agreed to the plan sooner. Hisparatha was always going to stomp down with a metal boot. Blue bloods don't know another way." Oates placed the missive back on the table. "Think this sorcerer is the one that sailed in on that big ship? The one the galley mongrels were so scared of?" "The starving man," Jackal said, raising his eyebrows to show he thought it was likely. "If the crown has given him leave to kill the halflings, he'll be formidable. They wouldn't provoke Zirko unless they thought any retaliation could be met." Oates agreed. "Reckon that's why Zirko just hadn't told his tunnel boys to throw the gates open and let the Unyars ride in." "Zirko may be angered, but he's never foolish," Fetching said. "No need for his own warriors to die when he knows we'll do it for him." "We don't have to," Jackal said, drawing a stern look from the chief. "Fetch, we could let this go." Fetch pressed a finger into the table. "We let this go, and we never get another chance. It's spring, Jack. Kalbarka has already been bolstered with men and supplies. They'll only get stronger. If they find all the halflings, Zirko's reasons to help us die."
"We could wait, force him to help himself."
"And if he decides that he'd rather lose a few dozen acolytes than lose half the Unyar horsemen? Between the river, the walls, the guns, and whatever magic this starving man can sling, the Unyars better pray Great Bellico is on their side. And what are the chances of that, given where we know his tongue to be?"
"So you want us to ride at the magic and guns?" Oates asked.
I'm saying Zirko won't risk it. But we have to. Leaving Kalbarka in Crown hands will see them win this war by summer.
Jackal leaned forward, took a deep breath. Chief, if we all die during this attack, the Crown wins within a fortnight. Fetch picked up another slip of paper.
Which is why I've made Zirko give his word that if we aid his people now, he'll have the Unyars take the field against his Sparta's armies. They'll ride with us to help Tarif at the Castile, and after, to retake Thricehold. That's 10,000 horses, bows, and swords that would have done nothing but protect Strava otherwise.
Oates slid the kerchief from his head. It was itching something awful from the day's sweat.
Why don't the halflings flee? After what I've seen with Barsius, you can't sell me they don't have 100 secret ways out of the city.
It's holy ground for them, Oates, Jackal said. Somewhere down there is a relic of Bellico or one of his brothers. Another eye of a big, thick cock? Jackal made a disappointed face. You've had better. Oates shrugged. I'm tired.
We're all tired, Fetch warned.
They won't abandon that site, Jackal finished quickly. Fetching stood.
So we seize this chance. Rant tells me the ships will be ready before week's end. We sail the instant the last nail is hammered, or not tied, or whatever the fuck. Hells, I hate boats.
You should sleep, Fetch, Jackal said. He stood. We all should. Oates stayed where he was. He stared at his friends.
What is it? Fetch asked.
The question was patient, despite her obvious weariness.
Bellico's tongue, Oates replied. You said we know where it is. What if Zirko does too?
Jackal chewed on an answer, but didn't produce one. The room was silent for a span.
He might, Fetch said at last. Though I think if it were so simple, he would have reclaimed it long ago. He wouldn't need to have dogs like Barsius sniffing your crack for a trail. And I don't think Zrika would have relinquished it if she thought doing so would put it at greater risk of falling into Zirko's hands. She found a new guardian for it. We all know how dangerous Crafty is. If Zirko knows, let him confront the wizard. Those two killing each other wouldn't be the worst outcome.
Fetch, Jackal said, the word a reproach. Zirko saved me. He saved you. The chief looked down at the table, her jaw clenching. When she looked up again, there was no anger in her eyes, only more fatigue.
Bellico isn't our burden anymore. Zirko can go on thinking we're hiding the tongue or not. Right now, I could care a fuck.
Fetch glanced at Jackal.
He's helped us in the past, always with something to gain. This is no different. We help save his people, we get Kalbarka and the largest army in the lots. Agreed?
They had. And now, the planning and preparations complete, they sailed. Oates's second passage through the gut was easier than the first. It wasn't storming, for a start, and the merchant galley, far larger than Burgos's boat, navigated the strait with less drifting. The Tower of Herathos and Rukam Ulnul, pillars that marked the gateway between worlds, came and went without peril. Soon, the river delta opened to embrace the fleet. The Tradrian corsairs did not enter. As ordered, they came about and set a course back east. Traveling upriver, the fleet plunged deeper into the estuary, flanked by white dunes keeping the salt marsh beyond at bay. Gangly water birds high-stepped along the banks and through the bogs, keen eyes and pointed beaks on the lookout for unwary fish. Oates kept his eyes on the sky, stockbow in hand. This was Roke country. It was doubtful one of the massive raptors would attack a ship, but he wasn't about to be as complacent as some damn fish. The chief's Roke hadn't recovered enough to make the journey. Jackal had broached the idea of stopping in the Old Maiden for Fetch to master another, but she'd swiftly dismissed the notion.
No time, she said. I was dizzy and sick for days the first time, remember? Yes, but you understand it now. You're stronger. Jack, there's not time.
True to the chief's order, the fleet did not tarry. By dusk of the first day on the river, they reached the meeting point with the shards. Notch and 60 mounted mongrels sat their hogs on the eastern bank, watching as the ships moored. Oates disembarked, joining Fetch and Jackal on shore. Together they tramped through the reeds toward the shard's chief, but it was the hatchet-faced mongrel beside him they greeted first.
"There are my fellow bastards,"
Polecat said, smiling as he dismounted. They all embraced him, even the chief.
"Heard you were nearly killed and your beard fell out,"
Polecat said, clapping Oates on both shoulders.
"It did. This is a whore's minge."
"So long as he gave her a good ride on that face, eh?"
There was laughter all around. Notch came down off his hog, the river wind snapping the embroidered scarves tied about his head and waist.
"You made good time," he told Fetch.
The Shard's fortress of Shatterhand lay due east from the river, separated from the gut by the fangs of our father's lot. Fetch took in the assembled riders.
"No luck finding Colquhoun?"
"None," Notch replied. "I sent patrols, but they came back shaking their heads. Not even a single Ulyud."
Oates could tell Fetching was disturbed by the news of the Fang's absence, but she didn't dwell on it long. Colquhoun and his half-naked band of thick-worshipping mongrels had kept their own queer ways since the Hoof's founding. Those ways had only grown stranger with the arrival of the chief's twin brother and their resurrected elven mother. Hells knew where that gaggle of zealots and sorcerers had gone. Fetch suspected Dargest. Wisely, she had not hung her planning on the Fang's participation.
"Good to know the orcs are staying away," she said. "What about Sparthus?"
"Scouted it myself," Notch told her. "Frails have it occupied, like you reckoned."
"They see you?"
Notch shook his head.
"Me and my boys know how to stay out of sight. There's 60 men on the island, arbalesters mostly. They're clustered near the southern end, waiting for you. The city may be a ruin, but it makes for a strong redoubt, and a watch post. The frails there can give Kalbarka ample warning if you come up river. Try to sail through and your decks will be raked with thrumbolts from the old walls. The bigger threat waits at the north end of the western channel. 3 war galleys. And they've learned their lesson. No slaves on those ships. Rowers are all men-at-arms. No going around because, as you know, the eastern channel is already impassable."
Polecat sniggered and pointed a pair of splayed fingers at Oates and Jackal.
"Heard that was you too."
"Seemed to recall it was the frails that set the bridge on fire," Oates said, looking at Jack.
"Can't really take the credit," Jackal agreed, with a jaunty tilt of his head. Notch sucked his teeth.
"Well, Alunan fire will do that, and those galleys upriver have plenty."
"This redoubt on Sparthus," Fetch pressed. "Any cannons?"
"Not yet, but they could bring them downriver at any time."
The former sellsword thought a moment, rubbing a thumb beneath his stubbly chin.
"I don't think they'll make the effort, though. They know you don't want Sparthus. That pile of rock is just a good vantage with a heap of cover. Frails will keep their strength at Kalbarka."
Jackal raised his eyebrows at the chief. "Meaning no wizards at Sparthus?"
"Right," Fetching said, eyes going blank for a moment. She made a decision, nodded once. "Get Hood."
Jackal ran back to the ships without hesitation.
"What are you thinking?" Notch asked.
Fetch answered him with her own question.
"You hear from Pulpier?"
"Yes," Notch replied, frowning at the dodge. "He's waiting at Black Knuckle. Said the Brotherhood would be ready to ride when we arrived. Tusk Tide is there already."
Fetch pointed at the less burdened of the 2 merchant galleys.
"Get your mongrels and barbarians loaded onto that boat."
It's the Stylark, Oates said. Fett shot him a barbed look.
Notch expelled an uncomfortable laugh.
War Chief, did you not hear when I spoke about the rain of bolts from the island and the blockade of ships?
I heard.
So rather than load my hogs onto a boat, let's offload yours and we can ride to Black Knuckle.
The river's quicker, Fett said, without looking at Notch. She was too busy drawing her katara's to check the edges on the blades. And I got nearly 300 mongrels without mounts who wouldn't know how to straddle a razor even if I gave them one.
Notch stepped closer, lowered his voice. You'll lose most of them trying to run that channel. The rest will burn when you reach the blockade. You can't.
Fetch turned away from the frustrated hoofmaster and moved to meet Jackal and Hoodwink as they rode up from the bank leading the chief's hog.
None of ours are going to die, Notch, Fetching said, climbing atop Womb Broom. Get your hoof on board. We'll be back before dawn.
The chief spurred her hog without another word, Jackal and Hoodwink at her flanks. They followed the river north at a gallop. Notch turned to Oates.
She can't intend to clear the frails off Sparthus with just them two to help her, Oates said. Yes, Shard. That's what she intends to do.
Polecat shook his head and laughed with appreciation.
Hells, those three make me hard!
The sight of them riding away did something entirely different to Oates. Gritting his teeth against the unpleasant broth of worry brewing in his craw, he turned to face the shards.
Loading hogs ain't swift work, Oates called out so all could hear. Let's get to it. You got an ornery pig? I need to know now.
It took near half the night, but in time, the Stylark was sitting as low in the water as the Fatback, holds echoing with the snorts, grunts, and squeals of the confined barbarians. The shards milled on deck. They used dice, hushed conversation, or mute vigilance to mask their uncertainty about being on the water, depending on the mongrel. None slept. Polecat ran a hand along the rail and scrunched up his face.
I don't know. Think I'd have named her Young Whore. Wet, salty, and filled with the pork between 50 mongrels' legs.
Oates huffed. Then the other should be the leaky cod.
Had that a time or two,
Polecat said, tugging at his sack through his breeches.
From whores young and old. Worth it.
Roar wanted to name one Squeal Hall, Oates said, hoping to shepherd the banter away from Cat's poxy cods.
Polecat weighed the name, gave it a hum of approval. After a heartbeat, his brow furrowed.
Who?
New mongrel. Oates pointed hard at Cat. Stay away from his sister, believe me.
Half-breed with a sister? By blood?
Oates nodded. Polecat's eyes brightened.
She comely?
Hells.
Oates couldn't help but laugh at the futility of warning the lecherous mongrel away from Quim.
Don't come whinging to me when the brother stoves your skull in.
Deal. What's her name?
Rant. Polecat made a strained noise.
I just spent.
Oates could only shake his head, but the smile on his face wasn't forced. Strange to admit, but he'd missed Polecat.
What'd she want to call them?
What? The ships?
Oates had to think.
Drift and drove.
Cat's eyes narrowed.
I don't get it.
Two names for a bunch of swine.
Ah, clever. I like them clever.
You just liked them.
True.
There was a pause.
Naming boats is fun.
They saw a glow flush the sky long before their brethren returned. It was too early yet for morning, but none would have looked for the sun to come up in the north, and no dawn had ever colored the horizon such a fuming green. The bodies came next, bobbing downriver in increasing numbers as the night wore on. All activity on deck ceased, replaced by a silent communal vigil as the mongrels leaned on the ship's rail to witness the current carry the dead past. When the three hogs appeared on shore, Oates was relieved to see each bore a rider. Hoodwink's pale flesh was dyed with blood, none of it his. Jackal's clothes were slashed and torn, but whatever wounds had resided beneath had vanished. The chief was damp and filthy with soot. She wasted no time and gave the order to sail as soon as the hogs were stowed. Soon, Oates could hear the pitiful thuds the corpses made against the hull. Sparthus and her island stood against a backdrop of pulsing green light. The mongrel fleet entered the western channel. Sharing the deck of Starlark with the shards, Oates watched Notch as they sailed between the ruins of the city and the crumbling fortifications of the western bank. The hoofmaster's sharp eyes peered at the shadowed walls and towers, Thrum in his hands, half-crouched and wary. Every one of his boys followed their chief's example. The storm of Thrumbolts they feared never fell. The only evidence of Hisparth's men were the lifeless flotsam in the river, and one lone corpse on the island, draped face down through a hole in the wall he must have chosen as his vantage. Oates imagined the man fighting sleep and boredom as he stood watch at that cranny. Imagine the yawn that was cut short by Hoodwink's knife. Likely he never knew that, all along the defenses, his fellows had died the same way, that others would follow. He'd awaken a hell of familiar faces with slit throats, pierced hearts, punctured lungs. The dark, nearly abandoned island had been Hood's hunting ground, Oates had no doubt. A place of the sleeping, the unaware. But there would have been too many to butcher, even for the silent ghost of a mongrel. Jackal had helped, likely hit the main encampment. Oates couldn't see it from the river, but it was there, somewhere behind the ragged walls. It would have been necessary to cause a commotion, force all the sentries to come running from their nooks. Waking to a half-orc in dark desert robes setting upon your camp would have caused the needed ruckus. Some man or another would have cried out, thinking it would bring aid, ignorant that it was exactly what the ambusher wanted. The shouts of alarm would only have increased as the lone mongrel began cutting men down, one against dozens, heedless of the blades fortunate enough to touch him before their wielders were slain. Those cries hadn't reached the mongrel fleet far downriver, but they would have reached the human ships anchored at the end of the channel. What remained of the war galleys now came into view. Several shards surrounding Oates cursed, and all were forced to squint against the emerald blaze. Two of the three ships were half sunk, what remained above the waterline awash in Alunan fire. The third was fully submerged. It would have been lost to the darksome river, but the tales of the alchemical substance continuing to burn underwater proved true. The Guadalquivir held a torch entombed in its depths, a bubbling, flickering phantom. Above that unnatural sunken light, the water steamed. Oates's spine crawled at the sight, his nostrils filled with the stench of charred and boiled meat. The crews of the doomed ships might have heard the men dying on the island, but it was likely they were already lifting their own voices in panic. They wouldn't have remained brave long once the chief was in their midst. The mongrels at the oars rowed carefully through Fetching's work, threading their ships between the burning wrecks. Crownbreaker was in the lead, and the tip of one oar brushed a blazing spar. The oar ignited in an instant, but the rowers were swift to cast it overboard before the hellish fire reached the ship. Aboard Stylark, every mongrel held his breath until they were clear. Oates caught Notch's eye. The hoofmaster grinned and held both hands up, palms forward in a gesture of pardon for his doubts. Next to Oates, Polecat gave a strange little cough. It could have been from the smoke, but something about it sounded forced. "The chief! She's gotten... I mean, she's become..." "I know," Oates said, as they left the fires behind to burn and the corpses to drift. The Cauldron Brotherhood's castle was almost as unsightly as their sway-backed chief.
It wasn't uncommon or unwise to build defenses on elevated ground. The Castile had its promontory, Thricehold its rumored dormant volcano, but whoever built Black Knuckle had tried to put too much fortress on too little of a rise. There was no room for a curtain wall on the knob of rock, so the castle was nothing but a bloated keep constructed in an artless triangle. Two of the walls were straight, though of uneven length, and the third curved outward. Some fool ass had decided to attempt to cover the exterior in iron plates, but ran out of metal long before they gained sense or lost patience. Time and weather had not been kind to the perceived reinforcement. What plates remained were rusted and pocked, staining the bare patches of wall with umber tears. The travesty of a stronghold reminded Oates of the grossly fat fighter he'd briefly known at the Pit of Homage, who often sat on a stool entirely too small for his bulk. The man had died on that stool. Someone went to rouse him for his next fight and found him an upright corpse with half a slack face and his pupils wide as a well. Oates reckoned Black Knuckle was about as formidable. Thankfully, they weren't here to stay. The blister of stone serving as the castle's perch sat at the end of a long, bald, and narrowing ridge. Oates rode toward the one and only entrance, a small gatehouse built out from the keep, connecting it to the ridge, a puckered navel on the stronghold's distended belly. He and Ugfuck were behind Fetch. Notch rode at her left, Borlip on the right. His tuskers were camped farther back on the ridge, beyond the tiny village that inevitably sprouted up near a hoof's fortress. Oates didn't catch the name of the place, but Winsome hadn't been as desperate and bleak-looking, even in its final days. If the Sons of Perdition enjoyed the best land in Ulwundulus, a strong argument could be made for the Brotherhood suffering the worst.
"It's a wonder the Fix never took this place," Borlip muttered as they waited for the screeching portcullis to rise.
Oates couldn't tell if it was derision or respect in the tied master's voice. His massive lower fangs kept his mouth fixed in a permanent snarl and rendered every word into a rough expulsion. Whatever Borlip's opinion, Oates would have been content to wait on the river, but the chief had insisted he accompany her the several leagues to the heart of the Brotherhood's lot, leaving Jackal with the fleet as a precaution against any Hisparthan vessels. At least it gave Ugfuck a chance to leave the ship's hold and run. He was snorting and farting happily in the sun until the gates opened. Black Knuckle possessed no yard. The gatehouse tunnel led directly into the keep and to what passed as the Brotherhood's stables. It was a low, wide chamber, lit by only a few arrow slits and even fewer fat lamps. Slopheads worked diligently in the gloom to keep the stalls clean, but without the wind, the stench of hogs would always prevail. But it wasn't the smell that most disturbed Oates. It was the harrow stags. A pair of them stood together in a single stall, their antlers glowing a pale eldritch blue as they stamped in agitation. A tine woman risked being inside the stall with the great animals, hands and voice working to soothe them.
"The hells is a Ruskin doing here?" Notch asked.
Fetch didn't answer, but the pained look she gave Oates as she dismounted didn't ease his confusion. She turned her hog over to a slophead and approached.
"Oates, I didn't know if they'd agree, so I didn't tell you."
The presence of the stags, the elf, Fetch's expression, all had conspired to hold Oates in place. He was stuck astride Ugfuck, looking down at the chief. Her hand was on his knee, he noticed, with a queer detachment. Why was he so dumbfounded?
Tell me what, he managed. Agree to what?
Crafty was right, Fetch said, her words measured. I couldn't win this war, because I've never waged one. I know how to fight. I can kill better than any now. But a war isn't a fight. It's battles and sieges. It's making choices with information days, weeks old, or none at all. The Hoofs haven't had a conflict like that since the incursion. That was our last war. So I needed someone, the only one who knew how it was fought. I needed the last mongrel to stand against Hisparatha and win.
The last? Fetch, the Claymaster's dead.
Fetch's hand squeezed his leg. Every chief has a strong right hand, Oates.
There was movement in the arch leading farther into the keep. Warbler stepped from the shadows. The old thrice stood tall, his white mane falling to broad shoulders. His eyes, long ago squinted by the sun, remained sharp as a hawk in his craggy face. He walked deeper into the chamber toward them, carried on strong limbs. The last Oates had seen him, he was limping, one leg swollen by pus to near twice its width. But there was no sign of weeping sores upon his body now. No feverish eyes or sallow flesh. No evidence of the sorcerous corruption he had attempted to absorb. The Tynes had finally cured Warbler of the plague. For a moment, Oates dared to hope. If the sickness no longer had its claws in the aging mongrel, then perhaps it was also banished from... No. If that were true, fetching wouldn't sound so strange. She wouldn't look so grave. So damned sorry. Oates got down from his hog, the movement freeing him from Fetch's touch. He'd known. From the moment he saw the stags, he'd known.
He's dead, isn't he? He said,
forcing himself to look Issa in the eye, just so she was forced to meet his.
Come with me, son, Warbler said.
The strength of that resonant voice had never failed him. They had placed Wiley in a small chamber. There was no window, just the same awful slit. He was on cot, a colorfully woven tine blanket pulled up to his chin. It was elven practice to bequeath the dead such coverings. A gray-haired Tyne sat by the boy, his voice issuing a low, melodic chant. Oates didn't know if there was any magic in that song. He hoped so. But be it potent sorcery or mere lullaby, it was beautiful and comforting. Wiley's head was a misshapen lump, his face all but eclipsed by the plague's putrescent touch. Oates began to cry. It wasn't the sight of the boy that demanded his tears. It was the sound of his wet, ragged breathing.
It won't leave him, Oates, Warbler said, a step removed. I could share it with him, but not hold it entire.
So you had them stop trying, Oates said. He didn't care that it came out as an accusation, didn't care that his nose dripped. Only for now, Fetch's voice, gentler than he'd heard it for months. Gentle because she was trying to pardon herself. Oates lowered himself to the floor beside the cot. He wanted to put his hand on Wiley's belly, to feel it rise and fall, but worried the weight would crush what shallow breaths were left to the boy. Instead, he rested his elbows on the cot and put the knuckle of his thumb against the lobe of Wiley's ear. Beryl had told him to kill his affection. Oates remained on the floor next to the cot and swore he never would.
Chapter 20.
And you'd think they'd be good cooks. It would make sense. Look at the kiln. Well, I mean, you can't look at it because it's on the other side of the lots, and it's all fallen down besides. But think about the kiln. Bastards were sappers. They destroyed castles. So it makes sense that their castle was well built. All the rudders were whores. Polkad is a wizard of fucking. Skull sowers? They were grave diggers. Reason why the furrow is underground, and their brothers are all really scary. So why is it, Oates, that if the Cauldron Brotherhood started as cook's servants, why is it that they're the worst fucking cooks in Ulwandulas?
Oates didn't respond. Not that culprit needed him to. The young mongrel hardly took a breath before continuing.
No jest! The hogs think twice before shoving their snouts in the troughs. And I'm fair certain they ate better than us. You should have seen this soup. No, you should have smelled it. Reminded me of the time all us slops got the trots because Grocer refused to waste spoiled meat. He ever do that when you were a hopeful? Hells, I wager he did, the old miser.
Oates had to resist spurring Ugfuck to a faster gait. He liked Culprit, and it was good to see him, but much like the shits from Grocer's rotten victuals, the flow of words hadn't ceased all morning. The occasional grunts Oates conjured in reply weren't helping, forcing the younger mongrel to fill the silence. This time, Oates attempted to ignore him completely, eyeing the clouds gathering in the eastern sky. They darkened in quick order and looked to have a powerful need to get rowdy. Rain wasn't plentiful in Ulwandulas, but storms in early spring made up the bulk. They'd be riding wet by afternoon.
Anyways, Culprit went on, never been so glad to see the chief. These last months have been... I don't understand why Shed Snake didn't get stuck with the Brotherhood. Lucky son of a thick's been living all comfortable with the tide. Think the chief likes him better than me? Always reckoned I was her favorite. Good to be riding again and away from there, though. What does that say, that I'd rather go besiege a city than stay another day with Pulpier and his shitty food? And by that I mean he feeds his hoof shit.
Culprit may have been relieved to put Black Knuckle behind him, but Oates hadn't yet left. His body sat Ugfuck, leagues from the fortress. His mind, however, was still in that dim, stale-aired chamber where Wily lay. Oates had tried to remain close, but it didn't take long for his bulk to be nothing but an impediment in the cramped room. The old Tyne worked around him with the patience of a growing tree, changing Wily's dressings and bedclothes, rubbing ointments into his corrupted flesh, laving his body in the smoke of various smoldering herbs, and guiding liquids into his mouth with a hollow length of bone. No matter the act, the gentle singing continued. The elf was as unmindful of Oates as he was diligent with Wily. The child was alive and suffering, but his caretaker was devoted to his comfort. Oates wasn't made to feel unwelcome, simply unnecessary. Still, he'd lingered until the needs of war required his attendance, even if they couldn't demand his attention. Fetch and Warbler held a private council for the meat of a day before calling the other chiefs in to palaver. When they emerged in the late watches of the night, the plan was made and orders given. The hoofs rode out the following dawn. The column striking out from the Brotherhood's lot was the largest concentration of mounted mongrels Oates had ever seen, well above 300 in number. He hadn't realized, not with such clarity, how effective Sluggard and Thresher had been in their recruitment runs into Hisparth. The fruits of their two-season labor had bolstered the ranks of the hoofs. Most Fetching had sent to the Wallow for training. Next to Father, she trusted Borlit more than the other chiefs, and he'd swiftly turned the best of the bunch into competent, if inexperienced, hoof riders. The Tusked Tide now counted 121 half-orcs, bringing them to a strength they hadn't known since their founding. The Cauldron Brotherhood had swelled to over 80. An equal number of free riders and Notch's 60-odd shards completed the assembled cavalry. Of all the chiefs, only Tomb had refused to take in new blood. Fetch had not summoned the Skull Sowers to Black Knuckle, thinking it best to leave them in the east to keep an eye on the Hisparthan army now in possession of Thricehold. Oates hoped that those 24 mongrels and the 200 sons at the cradle wouldn't be the difference between victory and defeat. Thankfully, the sizable drove of hogs now kicking up a cloud of dust was only one of the forces moving on Kalbarka. Jackal and the fleet continued their progress on the river, less than a league from the column's left. The former galley slaves had formed their own hoof, though they rode waves and not barbarians. They had named themselves the White Wrists, after the stretch of pallid flesh left behind when their shackles were struck. It proved a challenge to set a proper pace between the hogs on the land and the ships on the water. The terrain didn't always allow the riders to remain in sight of the Guadalquivir, rendering the first stretch of travel a frustrating exercise. But Fetch and Warbler had it sorted before the sun was too high, sending outriders back and forth to the river to ensure the strokes of the oar matched the drum of the trot.
Shedsnake galloped up from the latest such run and waved his scarred arm back in the direction he'd just come.
Cole, you're up.
Culprit made a face. All these mongrels, and it still falls to the bastards to keep an eye on a bunch of boats.
You're free to bring that gripe to the chief, Snake said.
Culprit hesitated, mouth half open, hands scratching at the shaved half of his head as he considered.
You are her favorite, Oates told him, nodding toward the distant head of the column where Fetching rode.
Culprit's mouth clapped shut, and he turned his hog toward the river. Shedsnake chuckled, guiding his hog into step next to Ugfuck. The easier pace allowed him to pull the half cape he wore over the puckered flesh of his left arm. All this time later, and even heat from the sun still caused the old burn to pain him. He took in the growing storm head.
That'll be a gully washer before long.
Oates grunted in agreement. He could feel his brother bastard peering at him.
I won't offer any chatter, Snake said after a moment. Figure culprits filled your ears to bursting by now.
Appreciate that.
Oates let the silence rule for a dozen hoofbeats or so.
Polecat's got him convinced he's a sex wizard.
Shedsnake burst out a laugh so loud it drew backward glances from the nearest shards riding ahead. Oates couldn't help but let his own mirth bubble out.
Didn't dare venture to ask if he had some first-hand knowledge of that.
Shedsnake gave an over-exaggerated shiver.
Hells, can you imagine?
No, thank you. I've seen Cat with a woman. Almost more than I could handle.
Ah, enough! We all have. That fucking narrow face all...
Snake contorted his own features into a wide-eyed, teeth-bearing mask of intensity. It looked nothing like Polecat, but was somehow perfect.
Don't pretend you don't know, Oates called to the spying shards. You've seen it too.
I'm amazed they didn't kill him, Snake said, as the other hoof riders turned their shaking heads forward once more.
I'm amazed we didn't.
Oates nodded.
But you want to hear something queer? I missed him. Polecat.
I know, Shedsnake said.
I did too. Don't fucking tell him.
Oates raised a pledging hand. They rode for a moment in silence. Shedsnake looked ahead, his smile sobering without vanishing entirely.
I understand why the chief split us up, he said.
His scarred arm emerged from beneath the cape, just long enough to wave a hand to encompass the column.
Couldn't have done this if she hadn't.
I get it. But
a hoof, it's... I don't want to sound backy, but it's family, Oates said.
The pair of words came out sharper than he'd meant for them to.
Snake exhaled.
I keep thinking about our slops. Turo was so close to getting his brigand. And Goss,
it don't bear thinking on, Snake.
Hog shit and dishonest advice. Oates amended it quickly.
Leastways not until all this is over.
Oates, I know what the chief did. Asking Warbler to come back. What that did to why...
Oates cleared his throat, loud enough to cut off the rest of Snake's words.
She did what she had to. Same as she did with our hopefuls. I understand that. In earnest, I do.
You say so.
I do.
Because you don't...
Reckon we ought to tell culprit that the Brotherhood were scullions back when? That they scoured the cauldrons, not cooked in them?
Shedsnake shook his head, face falling as he took the hint.
Reckon not.
The clouds were pissing stronger than a drunkard by the time Oates made his run to the river. The storm provided relief from the sun, but brought its own gaggle of miseries to replace the swelter and glare. Snake was right. It was a gully washer, transforming Ulwandulis's dusty crust into a friable morass. The going was slow, leaving Ugfuck slathered in slung mud after traversing a pair of the storm's namesake. The hoofs had other names for this breed of rain. Frog strangler, ass chapper, for nothing rubbed the seat raw like riding in wet leather. Rounth had coined Twixt Splitter,
after what one such rain had done to the stretch of flesh between his seed sack and asshole. The gray bastards had all shared a laugh when Fetching retorted with double gash for the same reason. Oates recalled the humor, but not the ride that birthed it. Just one of dozens of orc hunts, notable only because it had rained and no one died. They wouldn't have been making jests otherwise. It was rare back then for Fetch to crack wise, so the Claymaster was certainly not among them that day. But Oates knew the memory was flawed, for his mind saw Mead, Rounth, Hobnail, and Grocer there, which was likely true, but they rode alongside other now-dead mongrels who wouldn't have been. Creep, and Gripper, and Marrow. Dumdor. A hoof that never was. Oates didn't reckon he'd live to old age. Few sworn riders did, preferring to stick to the creed. But he wondered if, somehow, he survived long enough to pass his remaining days seated on a chair instead of a saddle, telling tales of his time wearing a brigand, how much truth would be left in his murmured memories. Likely little, being earnest. Brothers who never met in life would fight side by side in battles far larger and more courageous than the day they occurred. Mongrels who never smiled would laugh heartily. All the horrors would be beautiful, and every war would end in victory. Perhaps that was reason enough to die on the hog. It kept a mongrel honest. The river came into view, near to bursting its banks from the downpour. The storm had slowed the fleet some, but not enough to worry. Oates would return and tell the chief to ease the column's pace for a span. With luck, it wouldn't cause a delay in her plan. The river was already beginning to bend from its northward course. In a few leagues, the fleet would be sailing easterly, marking the final stretch to Kalbarka. In the mountains north of the city, the bandits and brigands under Anvil's command would be gathering. Warbler had looked to Oates for a tally of their numbers, but was disappointed with the answer. Fact was, the cutthroats skulking in the smelted mounts numbered in the thousands, but it was impossible to say how many would agree to aid in the assault. Oates had no doubt Anvil had earned the respect of many, and the fear of more. Combined with Jacinto's sway among the brigands, and the prospects of sacking the city, men would come, but an estimate of how many was something Oates couldn't wager. "Count on none, and be grateful for whatever you get," was all he'd been able to offer. They'd know soon enough. By tonight, the column and the fleet would halt, well beyond sight of the city walls. The ships would moor on the western shore, and a group of mongrels would ride hard for the Smelteds. All had served there during the winter and been hand-picked by Oates. They were to meet with Anvil and return to report the size of her force. So long as it was sufficient, Fetch would be able to threaten Kalbarka from three points: the fleet from the river, the brigands from the foothills above, and the cavalry from the plains to the south. All should be in position by the following dusk. Oates waved to the ships, waited for one of the men on the distant decks to return the gesture, and turned Ugfok's head. He found Warbler riding to meet him. The old thrice's head full of hair, rare for a thrice, like Oates's beard, hung heavy beside his craggy face. The drenched white locks darkened to steely gray. Fully equipped with brigand, tulwar, and stockbow, his harness heavy with full quivers and braces of javelins, he looked capable of taking on an entire Ulyud alone. Seeing him approach, Oates realized Warbler rode better than Jackal. Untrammeled by the sodden ground, he came at a confident trot, sure in his seat and light with his guiding hand and the hog's mane. His former hog, Mean Old Man, was now Jack's, and though the offer had been made to return the animal, Warbler refused. This new barbarian he dubbed Old Friend, a name that had caused Sluggard to comment that there was a poet hidden at the center of the scarred, grizzled mongrel. By Warbler's own admission, he didn't know his exact age, but he had to be well into his 60s, older even than father. Perhaps the weight of years never slowed a thrice blood. Oates found the thought wearying.
Warbler reined up next to Oats, facing the river. He surveyed the fleet for a moment, water running through the creases in his face to dribble from his chin in a steady stream.
"Jacko seems to have that well in hand," he said. "Captain Jackal, the Backy Seafarer."
Warbler's wrinkles deepened as he grinned.
"Know what he'd say to me right now, if he were sitting there instead of you?"
It didn't take Oates long to produce an answer. He'd ask if you thought he couldn't handle a simple scouting run to the river and back. Otherwise, why else would you be here? Warbler nodded.
"That's his pride. Seeing a reflection of himself in the doings of others."
The squinted eyes moved away from the river and fixed on Oates.
"But that ain't you, is it? Thought like that never entered your mind?"
"No."
"Why am I here, then?"
"You're aiming to get my pardon for Wiley." Warbler stared at him for a while longer. He turned his hog.
"Let's ride back. We'll go easy."
Their hogs settled into a walk beside each other. It was always worse going slow, ass grinding into the saddle rather than poised above, as was done at a hard gallop. Oates could feel the abrasive scrape of his soaked breeches.
"My Twixt is going to be stinging something awful come sundown," Warbler announced.
"Just thinking that," Oates replied, repressing a small laugh.
"So are most of the mongrels up ahead,"
Warbler said, nodding forward at the column, though it wasn't yet in sight.
"That's what hoof training does. Gets us all thinking the same thing, the same way. Claymaster's notion, truth be told, and a damned canny one. That's the entire reason for the slopheads. A hoof could draw some whelp that could already ride, track, hit a flea with a thrum shot, even be some fucking terror with a slicer. He could have all the skills he needed, and the Claymaster said he still had to suffer the slops. Because he wanted to make certain he thought like his brothers."
Oates gave no reply. It seemed Culprit wasn't the only bastard with a need to ramble on this long ride. At least Warbler's slower, sonorous voice was easier on the ears.
"Once I was ousted, it surprised me how most of the nomads I'd meet weren't outcasts because of a failed challenge or killing a brother or any such deed. Most simply never earned a vote. Not because they were too weak or too stupid or hopeless in the saddle, but because they never learned how to think the way a hoof rider ought. Did you know many hide it? They tattoo themselves or get another nomad to do it for them, then they cut the ink with their own hand."
Warbler drew a demonstrative finger across the old scars crisscrossing the tattoos on his arm. Of course, his ink, and the puffy, pale tissue that now marred them, had been given by his hoof.
"Better to be known as some evil fuck that got exiled than as a skilled slophead that never earned a name because he kept doing things his own way."
Most of what the old thrice was saying wasn't new to Oates. Hells, Jackal had very nearly been such a slop. Too willful and rebellious for the Claymaster's taste from the first day in training. It was Oates who got him through. He'd had to knock Jackal flat one night and pin him down to prevent him from quitting. Oates